Good morning and to everyone. So, when we speak about destiny, we have basically certain oversimplistic ideas about it. And let me just first touch upon these and why I say they are oversimplistic. For example, there was a movie which went around and it was based on there was a dialogue in the movie which was based on a particular book, and I won't name the book. And all that it said is, if you really, really desire something, the whole universe conspires to fulfill it. Now, this is a very human-centric idea of life, that, well, the universe is at our service and it is meant to fulfill our desire. So, this is a very oversimplistic idea. Because desire is only one of the players among many that work out the process of destiny. Another oversimplistic view is that as you sow, so shall you reap. Now again, all these have truths. But when we use the word as I sow, so shall I reap, basically I am not, this theory is not taking into account that man is not cut off from the rest of the world. An example is given that there was a, when if you have to pay some money or debt to someone, that person gets born in your family as a child and he either throws away your wealth or he develops an illness in which you end up spending a lot of money, and then when the debt is over, he leaves, he dies. Now, this is an oversimplistic idea because in the process of the child coming into one's own life, there is not one parent, but there are two parents, there are people involved, there are family, friends, and so many other things. And as if paying the debt to the friend was the most, or extracting from him was the most important thing or the purpose of a human birth. So again, this is a very oversimplistic view that destiny is your karma. Whatever is your karma, based on that, destiny intervenes. Because again, it doesn't take into account that your karma is connected with so many people's life. When I do a karma, any karma in fact, any action, it brings happiness to some, it brings suffering to some. So it's not just my karma and I am reaping its rewards or punishment. Even if I am punished, it has repercussion on people who are connected to me. Supposing a person is punished for some bad deed in the past, then his punishment is one part. But what about his family? What about so many other factors which are connected? Sometimes a whole community is castigated. So this is an oversimplistic view of destiny. This is another very oversimplistic view. Again, it has a certain truth. As I said, all of these have a certain truth, but not the whole truth. For example, if we take a Buddhist doctrine of life, because there is no self really, but they believe in the rebirth and law of karma. So it's an energy which goes into creation and that energy bounces back at some point of time. So here it's very interesting because it becomes independent of the people involved. So in the first one, you have done some evil deed to someone and that person has his revenge. But when we take it purely as energy transaction independent of human being, then you have released an energy in the world. It will come back to you through whatever form. It's not necessary that it will come back to you through that particular form. And here also there is a certain truth in it. I have seen that certain experiences, patterns repeat themselves. And there are people who come into your life who are almost like a replica in terms of your transaction of something which you have missed in a previous person. As if, that same energy comes back in another way through another person. So this too, again, there is a partial truth, but not the whole truth. One thing which is should be very clear in all this, that this idea that the world is simply a question of reward and punishment, a tribunal of justice, where we look at God as simply a judge sitting there calculating our sins and virtues, is a very, very, I won't even use the word oversimplistic, it's puerile. It's too childish. It it's almost reduces God to a schoolmaster. And one thing, when we look at the universe and the real facts that confront us, to really reduce God to a schoolmaster is to do great disservice, to start with, to God, and or a set of rules which one must follow, based on which one gets reward or punishment. It does a great disservice to the whole idea of creation. Anyways, many factors in this, again we will not touch upon it. Another oversimplistic idea which often people have is that God does everything. So the question is, if God does everything, what is the role of my choice? Even my choices are being dictated by God. This is makes it a little more difficult, but the fact is that this is again oversimplistic understanding of destiny. So if we really want to take the full account, then we have to bring in the entire complexity of the universe, how it has been organized, planned, being executed, what is the great purpose behind it, why our souls have taken a human birth. And if we don't take into account all these, then we'll end up with such oversimplistic ideas of destiny, let alone changing it. For example, when we use the word changing destiny, creating our destiny, normally the thing that people have in mind is that how I can come out of suffering and be in a state of happiness. Now for that, I don't need to really change the destiny. There are people who will say, well, I need money, and money will give me freedom, it will give me happiness. So now, if we really say that changing destiny means to come out of suffering, basically we are again saying that the purpose of life is to be happy. But Christ chose to suffer, go through the painful agony of the cross. Socrates chose very consciously to drink hemlock. So did Mira, so did many others. So, well, these people who were great masters, to say the least, they could have changed their destiny, but they chose to go through the purifying fire of suffering. So there is a reason why suffering comes, and if we don't understand its logic and we just rush to create things, change things by, you know, then we are missing the whole point of creation, missing the whole point of our soul's journey and the attempt that is taking place here. Now, we go back to how this creation is designed or organized. There we will get the secret. So we go back to the Vedas, and the Vedas is described in many images that there is a mantle of darkness which covers the seed of light, and surrounding the mantle of darkness, there is the mantle of light around us. So we can visualize it as this is the seed of light surrounded by a mantle of darkness. And surrounding the mantle of darkness is again a mantle of light. So when, and that mantle of light doesn't have an end, it's infinity. So basically this creation operates at two levels. And I'm going back to the Vedic idea because that best explains everything. So there is Maya which measures out the infinite into finite forms and names. And this Maya has two aspects to it. One is Vidyamayi, where though the forms are given a finite form, name, quality, yet there is a complete understanding of the oneness behind it. This is the mantle of light. It never forgets the real purpose, that finite forms are ultimately connected to the infinite, and they have to discover or figure out their way of being connected with the infinite or reconnecting with the infinite without losing their finiteness. This is the whole game which is going on. And the other is the avidyamayi maya, which is the veil of ignorance. So there are two veils which cover the king or the master or the lord. One is the veil of darkness and the other is the veil of ignorance, of light. Now creation descends. It comes all the way through light and knowledge into ignorance. Now in ignorance, the original divine will. So here comes this idea that does divine control everything? Well, we can say that the original will is the divine will. There cannot be any other will. There is one will operating in this creation, one power, one wisdom in it, that's at the origin. And we use the word divine will or divine wisdom, whatever way we may say God's will, that's not the point. But one single ultimate reality which is all-powerful, all-knowing, that governs this universe. But as it enters into the play of ignorance, it has been created with a purpose, and we may or may not, you know, it's not necessary to touch upon it, but if necessary, we can talk about it. So as it enters into the play of ignorance, Since all the forces in the ignorance do not understand this will, they go on distorting it, modifying it little by little. That's why it is, we can say that ultimately in the last analysis and the first shot and the final shot is played by the all-knowing, all-executing, omnipotence and omniscience of God. But in between, there are many things which are coming into the play and they are distorting it, giving it its own little twist or trying to rectify it. And in the process, the end result of, they are not the end result, but the circumstances, situations that evolve, we face through life, they are of a nature which we cannot really directly attribute either to God or to the human conscious effort. For example, a person suddenly find that, you know, there are wicked things, actually ugly things that happen. There's no need to name them, but let's say murders happen or cruel deeds happen. Now, to say that everything is because God has planned it and it's God's will. So it's like saying that, well, God planned the cruelest of acts. But if we look at it from this perspective, that the God's will is never to commit cruelty, it's all beauty. But this all beauty, the moment it enters into the realm of ignorance, changes into the desire and will to possess beauty in a particular form. See, it is the same will, but it is now getting deflected, distorted. And then this will to possess, this will to acquire, this will to own, this will to almost completely hold it for oneself, leads to acts of cruelty against the very same object whom we claim to love. I am just giving one example. There are plenty of them which can be, you know, seen. So once we understand it, so there is an individual choice. Man is one of the players among many players. So there are many forces, and how they operate, the forces of ignorance as well as the forces of light. At any given point of time, there is a prompting from both of them. And I am talking of practically how it appears, and I am sure many of us may have experienced that there is a prompting of the light, and if we follow that lead, we may have to let go of the immediate object that would give us gratification and satisfaction. But in the long term, it releases us into freedom and light and joy. But on the other hand, there is a prompting which is of a kind where we need to grab the object, to hold it, possess it, etc. And the problem with that is the moment we try to hold and possess an object, we are held by it. We are bound by it. And this is called as attachment. So when we try to bind something to us or possess it, we are possessed by it and are bound by it. Now the moment we do it, then a kind of set of determinism. So with each action or attitude, there follows a chain mechanism that's inbuilt within creation. So if I pick up an object and hold it and possess it and I derive some joy in it, after some time, this attachment and the expectations that build up, after a time it is inbuilt in creation that I will no more be able to get the joy which I got initially from that object, and the very same thing to which I was attached, that begins to bring me pain. That which gave me pleasure begins to bring me pain and suffering. So people often wonder that why they are suffering, and they complain that it's because of Mr. X or Miss X. He did this and she did this. But that's not the point. The suffering came because I got attached to the object. Now this object came into my life, came near me with a certain purpose. But that purpose, original purpose, the divine will. So there is a divine intent why two things came close. Two people, let's say, came close. But it got deflected and distorted in the play of the ignorance. It got distorted within our own consciousness. It got distorted because of the, you know, world of ignorance, its forces, its prompting to which we listen. And finally, because of these promptings, because we have a role of making a choice, ultimately, the original intent got deflected, and the thing which came to help us progress became a challenge and resistance on the way. So this is one way we can understand that creation exists at these two levels. Now here then we have to understand that then what are the consequences? The consequences are simply to rectify an error. What is rectification of error here? It's not about reward and punishment. The rectification of error is a rectification in our thought, in our own will. So that will which should have been correct, straight, right, aligned with the divine will, this will has deviated, it has come under the influence of desired self. And therefore this will must go through a purifying suffering, understand that, well, this is not how my life, I can lead my life, because if I do it, I may get immediate gratification, but in the long run, I'm going to suffer. So this will slightly tries to align itself. And since thought, feelings, all of them are interconnected, so then we see that thought, feelings, attitudes, motives, this whole inner world, that is being shifted. There is a pressure of circumstances which compels us to change within. So when we talk about changing destiny, we should actually talk about changing within, changing our own self, changing our inner being, which means ultimately boils to changing our attitude. Now this again, if we see in real life, we will see instances. There are people who went through very difficult, challenging times. At the end of it, they learned something. And that something was so strange that we cannot change anyone else. I've met people who, suffered so much because they wanted to change their husband or change their wife, change their child. And they have gone to that extent, they have gone through pain, suffering. Even today, I met somebody who was mentioning that, now I have given up. And the man is in 60s. So I had given up about what? He said, I have given up, nobody listens to me, my children, wife, or whoever else is there. I said, you should have known this long back. See, what a waste of time. So instead of that, he has given up and he is sulking. He almost feels that, probably, okay, now it doesn't matter. I don't care whether I die or live. Now, this is the problem that whereas now slowly it has pushed him in that direction, where he realizes that I cannot change anybody else, I have to change myself. And to change myself means only one thing. And it is to align my will to the divine will, to align my thought with the great thought which is there in creation. And the great thought in creation is to take everything, that's the purpose of thought, to uplift everything towards the heights. The great impulse, the great love which is in creation, which gets mistranslated into very personal sentimental feeling. And again, this great love operating in creation is to lift everything toward the height, to purify, to refine, to sublimate. And the great power of life, which is moving all things, again to uplift, to expand, to grow and progress. So essentially, we have to make a choice at every level, because it applies at all levels. I may have the will that, well, I must progress, but my thoughts may be going in a different direction. So ultimately, we are here to know that basically, we are here to progress. And the progress takes place through happiness, progress takes place through suffering. Very often and paradoxically, a lot more through suffering than through happiness. Now, if we apply this logic, we begin to understand why good people suffer. We begin to understand why Pandavas had to suffer, why Draupadi has to suffer, why Lord Ram has to suffer, why Shurabinda and the mother had to go through such difficult and challenging time, why many of these sadhaks in the ashram had to go through this challenging time. Because they knew very well that, well, we have to progress, and the higher, and they were carrying upon themselves the burden of the world's progress. So higher we want to progress, the greater the leap, and therefore everything to which we are held on to and everything that to which we are attached, it may be just the body. There is a right attitude toward the body and a wrong attitude. The wrong attitude is to be attached, clinging out of despair, out of fear of death, out of fear of old age. This is a wrong way to get attached to the body. And the right way of dealing with everything is that, like my thought, like my emotions, like my life, this body too is an instrument of the divine will. So that's the right way of looking at body, taking care of it, simply as one would take care of an instrument. So basically, when we really look at life this way, then this idea that those who suffer is because of bad karma, it completely changes. In fact, perhaps those who are outwardly happy with luxurious life, where, they have so little inner, because that luxury brings its own attachments of a very vicarious kind. I mean, people who live in luxury cannot live for 5 minutes without AC. I have seen that they begin to suffer simply because the weather is. And today itself, somebody was mentioning that, you know, I would like to come to Pondicherry, but you know the weather. So I didn't say, but I thought in my mind, to lose your destiny because of weather or because of heat. It sounds so silly when we look at one level, that one is taking a decision, one feels within that I should be here. But the weather stands in the way. So I was thinking, what kind of slavery? So basically, I didn't say that. So at one pole, we are slaves, head to foot. And the more we are attached to this outward life, to the physical mind and senses and their pleasures, we are bound neck deep. And then we are running with a begging ball, seeking pleasure from here or there. We get something in temporarily, then we get knocked out, then we cry, we complain, we grumble, making it even worse. Because an empty bowl is bad enough, but filling it with complaints and curses is much worse. So we do that. Ultimately, we curse God, or we make a theory that my own karma or God's will. Now we can see how ridiculous it is. It's like saying God wants you to suffer, which is so absurd. And to say that it's my karma, as if God's grace, which is infinite, could do nothing about it. As if there is nothing like grace, it's just a rule, and a morbid rule, a mechanical rule in which nobody has a say. So it's time that humanity evolved out of all these things and started looking at things very realistically and takes into account the complexity of the play between two poles of one reality. On the other side, spirit with its infinite freedom. Spirit is not bound by any rule. It is the origin of all rules. These rules are nothing but habits and patterns which come in the course of evolution. So again, we have to understand there is nothing like an absolute rule in this universe. I mean, there are certain creatures which will die if they come out of the water because they breathe in water. If they make an absolute rule that, you know, there is no way one can live outside water, and they prevent all the fishes or the creatures of the marine world to come out, they would be doing a big mistake. But there are creatures who live on earth, they cannot live in water. So there is nothing like an absolute rule. With evolution, rules change. And this even in real life. There were things which were considered, this should take care of the moral right and wrong. There was a time when people were told that this is wrong and this is right, the society controlled them. Then as society evolved, it became more individual and subjective. And today if we see, then the whole entire understanding of the moral sense of right and wrong is undergoing a sea change. It's because there is an evolution, and evolution is what is progress. And progress and evolution, when we concentrate, it's yoga. So yoga is concentrated evolution. Yoga is concentrated progress. And integral yoga is an integral progress, because progress made in one dimension can be undone by progress or lack of progress or resistance in another direction. For example, and that's where Mother speaks of the contradictory wills within us. So a part of us wants to ultimately move toward that freedom, because it realizes that as long as I am moved by ignorance, I am bound. It doesn't matter. I may, in ignorance, I may wish something very, very dearly, and let me say with a sense of irony and humor, the whole universe conspired to give it to me. Next we will realize it was the most foolish thing I asked for. And there are so many instances in so many people's life that they asked for something, they got it, and then they suffered because they got it. And often I say this, you know, in the form of a little story. Someone went to a place where people were depressed, and one of them was crying out, Lulu, Lulu, and they asked him that, why are you unhappy? So the person said, well, I loved Lulu and I couldn't get married to her, so I'm unhappy. And the person said, yes, yes, I understand. The other person is also crying, Lulu, Lulu. He says, why are you unhappy? What has Lulu done to you? He said, no, I never thought about it, but I got married to Lulu and now I'm crying. And then there is a third person also crying, Lulu, Lulu. And he says, I don't know who Lulu is, but I believe she must be very desirable because these two guys are crying over Lulu. So that's how our life is. That's what ignorance does to us. It conceals the real sense of this universe. And all our theories of reward, punishment, karma, and God's ultimate will, all these, they are so childish because they have not taken into account the real purpose why we are here. And that's where we see, such a fresh, wonderfully fresh perspective based on his own realization that Sri Aurobindo gives us, that we are here for progress. And now one part of us wants to progress, other parts don't, or still others resist, some are slow. So this is called contradictory wills within us. So in traditional yoga, people just deny these things. Now the moment you deny these contradictory wills, which are in ignorance also seeking for some truth, then ultimately we just potentiate one part and we are free, let's say, in the mind, but we are not free in the heart. So we shun, interacting, because we are afraid, because we'll get bound, because we are not free in our feelings. Basically, true freedom is that it's regardless of any circumstance. And I was reading something very interesting from the mother, that people try to escape from the difficulty. Let me see if I can find the passage. I would like to read it. But how people try to escape from their difficulties. So, on one side, we can... just a moment, because it just came to me and it's something which I feel is important. Yeah, here it is. It has been noticed that most people who live alone in the forest become friendly with all the animals and plants around them. But it is not at all the fact of being all alone that gives you the power of entering into an inner contemplation and living in communion with the Supreme Truth. There are a lot of people who have this idea. And recently somebody had a massive heart attack. And the reason was that the dog to which the person was very attached, the person was not attached to anyone, had no that way family, no unmarried, etc. But this dog died. And that was enough to give a shock. We have the story of Jad Bharat. Perhaps it is easier when by force of circumstance you have nothing else to do. But I am not convinced of it. One can always invent occupations, and it seems to me, according to my experience of life, that if one succeeds in subduing one's nature in the midst of difficulties, if one endeavors to be all alone within oneself with the eternal presence while keeping the same surroundings which the grace has given us, the realization which one obtains then is infinitely more true, more profound, more lasting. And that's why people cannot understand many times when they look at the ashram superficially. In fact, mother says that if you want peace, go to the ashram next door. Of course, there is the peace here, which is of a very different quality. But here, difficulties surmount. Challenges surmount. Because this is not a place for runaway, or, it's not like a forest. The way it is constituted itself is very interesting. And that's the path to freedom. Freedom from karma, freedom from whatever, freedom from suffering, which she is showing to us. Many people shrink away from whatever they feel has given them pain. They never try to understand, go into the heart of the pain and see what is the wisdom that is that has led them where they are. They instead end up blaming someone. But one has to look into one's own attitudes. Very often this shrinking is due to fear. So the mother says, to run away from difficulties in order to conquer them is not a solution. It is very attractive. In those who seek the spiritual life, there is something which says, oh, to sit down under a tree, all alone, to remain in meditation, not to have the temptation to speak or act, how fine it must be. It is because there is a very strong formation in this direction, but it is very illusory. So, just on a little humorous note with regard to this, for example, if you go to the ashram, sometimes it looks very odd. If you are sitting for some time at the samadhi, somebody will come and say, no, don't meditate here. It's something almost very hard. You may feel, oh, this is very insensitive. Perhaps it is insensitive. And you are asked to sit somewhere you have lost that thread. But actually, if you look at it from the divine arrangement point of view, the message is that, well, if you want to realize divine, realize it in your everyday life. So this is the true freedom. So when we realize the divine in every movement, through our thought, feeling, life, and all the activities, all its multitudinous relationship, normal things, ordinary life, and yet we discover the inner freedom of the spirit, meaning thereby, just as God is in everything, impels everything, is the master of everything, connects himself to everything, binds himself to everything, and yet he is not attached to anything. So that is the secret I think we are here to learn, not that secret that if you desire something, the whole cosmos will conspire, but the secret which we find in the Isha Upanishad, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kinche Jagat Tyam Jagat Tena Taktena Bhunjita Magrida Kasya Suddhanam, that all this that is here is for the habitation of the Lord. So there is only one will, one supreme authority, one power to which everything belongs. Me and all those who are connected with me, the life, circumstance, everything, it belongs to that. So then what we should do? Tena taktena bhunjita. We should renounce this idea of possessing happiness, possessing pleasure, possessing joy. And then what happens? Then joy comes naturally to us. Ma grida kasya svidhanam tena taktena bhunjita. Meaning by renouncing you enjoy, you don't need to seek and possess anything and make it your own. It's a little inner shift. But this inner shift requires a tremendous inner effort. Because the whole human nature is shot through and through with the threads of the ego. They have spun in ignorance. Ego is the operating mechanism. In ego, in ignorance, the driving power is desire. And in our ignorance, we know that, you know, with these two operating, even when we try to get free, for instance, in the workings within this also, we have a choice. We have a choice from being completely bound to inertia and letting others make their choice, not realizing ki this is also a choice we make, that we let others make a choice. And or we go aggressively to get our things, both of which ultimately are choices in ignorance. But even when we try to make our choice based on the conception of right and wrong and duty, even that is ignorance. And so all of them ultimately keep us bound. And as long as we are bound, our destiny will always be, what Sri Aurobindo says, in this earth, twi-natured earthly life, dubious game. It will always look that something has played a spoil sport, something has, people often come and say, but we did everything right in our life, and yet we are suffering. So sometimes I just tell them, yes, because you did everything right in your life, you have to learn to go beyond your right, your idea of right, your conception of right, to the right, which ultimately the right with a capital R is what the divine will is. So ultimately tuning our nature to the divine will by getting rid of desire, by practice of equanimity, getting rid of ignorance, by practice of nishkam karma, is the path towards freedom. And this freedom doesn't mean now I can do whatever I wish to. People have this idea of omnipotence of God, that oh, he can do anything. The other day somebody was saying, I am praying with so much, so I want somebody to be cured, so Mother and Shubindu will cure, because all can be done if the God touch is there. That is how it was connected. I said, see, then I had to send what Sri Aurobindo has written, that as to prayers, not all prayers are granted or even can be granted, because we are not taking into account the complexity of the universe. There are many intertwined things. People have to grow and evolve. If you make life too easy, it's like a parent making life too easy for the child. And very often when they do it, we know that children grow up having some part which is weak, and it becomes very difficult. Some children, of course, manage it well. And of course, parents also, because they have transmitted some wonderful things to the children. But most children. So the divine doesn't act like that, that whatever you pray, I'll grant you. The universe doesn't operate like that, that whatever I desire, it'll fulfill. Very often, it thwarts the desire when we are very fortunate. If we are unfortunate, it fulfills the desire only to learn the lesson that it's not what we are really seeking for. And that's the whole play and the whole panorama and the whole claim. So to summarize, we have a role to play in our own destiny. And that role is to attune ourselves to the divine will. That's the, in one sentence, the role. And everything that happens in life comes to teach us that. If we learn fast, life is beautiful. It gives us constant joy and peace. If we do not learn it, suffering keeps coming our way. There is a role that God has to play. And that play is that there is a supreme will operating in this creation. Despite our ignorance, despite all the deflection and distortion of the forces, is leading us toward the great goal. And that great goal is that each element of this creation is impelled by the divine and is moving towards its own realization of its own divine possibility. So as human beings, our divine possibility is to become one with the divine, but matter, river, everything has to arrive at its own divine possibility so that there can be a true divine order, true divine harmony in this creation. That light, the determining factor in creation, whose will no power can ultimately abrogate, is the supramental. But there is also the role of so many forces which are playing around in the creation, which are at any given point of time impacting us. Initially, we are open only to the forces of ignorance, so we go through pleasure and pain. In the beginning, more pleasure, but as we begin to evolve, pain, because it's a teacher. It comes to teach us that the pleasure that we are enjoying is very limited. So we need to seek more. So pain acts as a spur. And then the forces of light open their doors and they begin to touch us because we are getting ready. The mangoes are coming in the market, so mango is getting ripe. And then a time comes when both of them are operating and inner life is a battlefield. And finally the divine grace which comes and starts putting its weight on our side. Now, when the divine grace comes and acts upon our side, then it annuls many of the hurdles on the way. But there the thing is that one has to open to the divine grace, then it takes care of all the forces of ignorance, all the attachments, all the desires in its own way, and that's how it cancels karma. The knot of karma is duality. Ultimately, when we understand karma, if I live in the sense of right and wrong, good and bad, I am subject to karma. Even a good karma subjects me to the law of karma. So even a right, according to my limited understanding, it binds me to the law of karma. But the moment I enter into a non-duality, in a state of oneness, not non-duality as it's used, but in a true state of oneness of the one divine everywhere, divine is the sole doer. The sign of that is that I know that the divine is the only doer. Then I am freed from the chain of karma, even if I am engaged in the most goriest of activities, which includes a battle, taking of life. So this is how we can have the complete panorama in a nutshell. Our whole business is to, our immediate business first is to come out of this life of ignorance towards a life of true oneness and inner unity. To renounce the ego or dethrone the ego and install the divine presence and the psychic being in its place. To abandon the law of desire and be impelled more and more by the divine will and the divine shakti. This is the road to freedom. And when we are thus free, it doesn't mean I can do anything and everything because I am one now with God. So I have to just raise my hand and do this and everybody will be cured. No, it doesn't. Because again, then I am disturbing the law of evolution and the path of progress. Yes, then one becomes an instrument of the divine design. And such people, if they say something, or yes, if they lift their hand under the will of the divine, then things may happen, which may look like miraculous. But they will not lift their hand unless, they will not speak a word unless they are impelled by the divine shakti within. So this is the picture as far as I have tried to give. Now, I can press the pause button and if there are some questions, I'll be happy to take.
Thank you, Dr. Rao. Is there any sort of particular procedure you would recommend or practice you would recommend for tuning?
Yes.
To the divine will?
Yes, tuning to the divine will, the first simplest practice, which I feel is a must for everyone, even in ordinary life, even if one is not doing yoga and sadhana, is Nishkam Karma. And Sri Aurobindo strongly speaks about it in essays on the Gita. It is the one practice which the Gita recommends, and Sri Aurobindo speaks about it, meaning thereby do your best and leave the rest in God's hand. This is the simplest of practice. Because, well, you are moved by desire, fine, do it to start with. That's how human beings are moved. And do it well, give your best shot. Don't shrink from the challenges that come, difficulties that come, don't give up. You have taken a course, go through it, you will see at the end whatever it has to teach you. But do it with Nishkam Karma, in the sense that even if at the end all your efforts collapse and they don't bring any result, take it as a lesson of life and move forward. This is a basic practice, most important, that I do my best in the best of my intention, best of my state, the highest that I can summon, which is usually in most human beings reason, not desire. So let me be impelled by the law of reason. I am not slaying desire, but I am moderating it under the governance of reason, what is called as a sattvic consciousness. And then I do things without any ill will, or whether with the will to hurt or injure or make someone suffer. I am doing something with the best intent, but the result may be just the opposite of what I thought would be. I may not want people to suffer, and people may suffer unknowingly, unwittingly. Now, or I may get unexpected results. I may have expected a kind of success, maybe whatever desire in moderation, but it doesn't get satisfied. Or I wanted a prize or a reward or a gift material, or let's take an example, somebody is doing social service or service to God. And one is doing it in real earnest in one's own way, but one faces insult, one faces condemnation, and one faces even failure. So one has to understand that your transaction is with the divine, not with what the world gives. If we are doing it for the world, then we have entered into another transaction. That's transaction with the forces of ignorance. So let the transaction be with the divine. Whatever we are doing, let's offer it to the divine to determine the result. This is a basic practice. Then, of course, equanimity is another basic practice. Trying to find the psychic being is a most fundamental necessity, I would say, for those who are taking up yoga, because without that, the ego plays 100 games. It will give you a feeling, no, all God is doing, and inwardly it is feeling very happy. See what a great sadhak I have become. So we have to, these are three basic practices. Find the psychic being. Love is a great purifier, and work is a great purifier. Don't run away, as we just read the mother. Take the challenge of life. Work, that's so important. Because people who too much believe in karma try to minimize the work and do only particular kind of work. And love is so important, because it is the first power and the last power that begins to liberate us from the ego. So shrink not from love, shrink not from life, shrink not from joy. That's lines from Sri Aurobindo's poem Rishi. And have faith in God, and then go through all the experiences. Don't condemn yourself, don't condemn others. Worst is to blame. Blame is the most primitive. Blaming others, blaming God, I mean, that means you have no power now. You have empowered others to have control over your life. So, take charge of your life. Even if you did good and somebody reacted in a way which brought a woe to you and suffering to you, yet you take responsibility that I did because I felt impelled to do it. So, these are some basic things which I would suggest. Yeah.
Namaste. I had put up a question. I had put up a question, and that is, if the purpose is to unite with the divine,
yes,
right, then why does the divine send us or manifest us, or however you want to use the word? Anyway, we were already united with the divine.
Yes. Now, so. Yeah. You can complete. Sorry.
No. That's it.
So that's what I had left this question hanging in the air, and thank you for saying that. I said that the dual nature, the ignorance and the law of light, and I said, well, there is a purpose to it, but we need not touch upon it unless there is a question. So basically it amounts to that, why life in ignorance. To start with, we were not united with the divine. There was no individual at all. In the beginning, there is only one. So one wants to become many, so it brings out of itself many, many little seeds which are within the divine. But these seeds are all the time joined. Obviously, then there cannot be many. See, this is the great paradox. That let's say, for example, you want to make ice cream out of milk and cream, or whatever it is made up of. So it's already there as a possibility and a potential. So each one is there as a great possibility and a potential. But for that, milk has to be, whatever is the process, but at the end of it, put in a separate cone, and where a new flavor has to be added. That's how the many are created. Otherwise, it'll be sameness. Now, why many? Why multiplicity? Simply because within the one, there are infinite possibilities. Infinite possibilities. So, these infinite possibilities, to express each of them, must have its own full course and go through their own challenges. If they are in the realm of light, they are just joining back immediately. It's like they are rushing back into the divine rather than going away. And I often give this example of life on earth, or probably other planets, how it will come. See, most of the, as far as I know, 92% of the photons do not escape from the sun because of the immense gravity of the sun. But 8% escape, very small amount. But thanks to these photons, life blossoms on earth. Now the photons which are there, already there, they are there as photons. That's how they are, producing whatever energy. But they are useless in terms of expressing the divine, the possibility of the sun. But those photons which come all the way, they have to renounce the home of the sun and they travel to earth. For them it must be quite a horror. Some drop into filth. Yeah, literally filth. But in the filth also they start energizing the mud to bring out lotus. They energize the animal to, the sloth, the slumbering pig. They energize man. So this is the reason why. Because then the multiplicity of the possibilities will blossom. It is challenging and daunting, no doubt. But because the divine is omnipotent, he could take this challenge. And because deep within we are connected with the divine, the soul has accepted this challenge. Let's put it like that. If we could have avoided it, but then there would have been no creation practically. By its very nature, it has to become finite, and first it has to be away. Always it is connected from the divine point. One day, if the sun completely blanks out, or few days, life will find so difficult. See, in Antarctica and Arctic, life just doesn't thrive because the sun is absent for so long and there is all ice. So, of course, we human beings have found way to sustain with oxygen and artificial systems, but it won't thrive. So we have to apparently, seemingly move away, though it is supporting it from behind. So that's how creation is. And if you look at it, that it creates variety, endless variety, multiplicity, the delight of the rainbow-hued life, then we can say, okay, we left the delight of unity and oneness for the delight of multiplicity, which is fine. It's a price we have paid, all of us. But perhaps in the bargain, perhaps staying in that oneness was too boring, if I have to use a human language. So it's okay. We have accepted the challenge, and with the challenges come many things. So it's fine. Yeah.
We didn't accept it. We just arrived and we had to accept
it. No, we have accepted it at the highest level. That's how Savitri describes the life divine also. In that state when we are in the divine, that's how it describes, that we accepted. Of course, we didn't know that we are going to have tears. Because that I agree. But that part which is inside the divine, even today, the moment we find the psychic being, the beauty is we accept everything. Consciously. Because we are in that delight of the play. We discover the delight of the play. But the veil of ignorance is, which makes us forget who we are, is the terror and terrible thing. So, yes, perhaps we didn't know when the veil of ignorance comes. What is going to be the long journey and the dangers and the difficulties, yes, to that extent, yes. That the unexpectedness of the play. And that's why the strict determinism of fate, as we try to make it oversimplistic, it's not there. This is the unexpected turn, but always ultimately. So finding the soul is to become really a master, because this is the first fellow who has the script, who is in contact with the script, who can take the right measures, give us the right attitude, make the right thought, the right feeling, not right by human standard, moral standard, social standards, but the right attitude, right gestures which flow from the soul at any given moment. So that's the first thing that we must discover.